WILL comes from the Corkscrew Wine Emporium, 203 North Vine, Urbana, with wines for the serious collector to the first-time buyer. This Saturday's wine tasting will feature 10 wines, including many new arrivals. Information is at 337-7704 or online at thecorkscrew.com.
WILL thanks Jack and Marjorie Richmond for their gift of the Richmond Journalism Teaching Studio, adjacent to Campbell Hall, for public telecommunication. It's 2:41. Let's take a look at sports now. 23rd-ranked Illinois and Penn State face off tonight in State College, Pennsylvania, and they're hoping for a better offensive showing than they put on last time. On February 18th, the Nittany Lions won a 38-33 decision at Assembly Hall. The Illini have already secured a place in the NCAA, but Penn State remains on the NCAA fence. Despite victories over the Big Ten's top teams, Michigan State, Purdue, and Illinois. Meanwhile, the Illinois women have finished up their regular season, and they're in Indianapolis today, preparing to play Penn State. The Illini are seeded ninth. The Penn State Nittany Lion women are eighth seeded. That will be the third game of the day. It is expected to start late this afternoon, 4:30 Eastern Time, 3:30 Central Time. Meanwhile, in the first game of the day in Indianapolis in the Big Ten tourney, Wisconsin beat Northwestern, the score 60-51. White Sox pitching coach Don Cooper is keeping a close eye on veteran Jose Contreras, and he's liking much of what he's seeing. Contreras is coming off a ruptured Achilles, and he threw 45 pitches from the mound yesterday. Cooper says Contreras is looking good and remains on pace to appear in games in mid-March. And defending champion Japan opened first-round play in the World Baseball Classic with a 4-0 win over China today in Tokyo. Team USA plays its opening round game against Canada on Saturday in Toronto. That's sports.
WILL programs are made possible in part by Bevere Cafe 2, offering gourmet sandwiches, salads, and specialty coffees with seating inside or outside in the lower courtyard of the Institute for Genomic Biology next to Morrow Plots on the U of I campus.
Next, we meet a man who works for the UN and who is in charge of trying to get an international deal on climate change. He's in Washington, D.C. this week, trying to stir up support for a new global warming treaty. He's finding friendly new faces in the Obama administration, but huge issues need to be resolved between now and December when the treaty is supposed to be negotiated in Copenhagen. NPR's Richard Harris reports.
Ivo de Boer has a clumsy title, Executive Secretary of the United Nations Framework Convention on Climate Change. At the moment, his job is really more like cheerleader-in-chief, or you could call him the Flying Dutchman as he travels the world trying to forge a climate deal that would replace the current ineffective climate treaty, which was negotiated in Kyoto.
About the only thing that I'm absolutely sure of is that 2009 will go down in history as the year of climate change. Either because we failed to seek what I really see as a unique opportunity, or because we took a decision to ride a wave of change.
Success won't come easy. De Boer says he has to get the United States to commit to deep and meaningful cuts in its carbon dioxide emissions. He has to convince developing countries like China and India to step up too. And last but not least, in the face of a global economic crisis, he has to convince rich nations of the world to come up with large amounts of cash to help poor nations cope with climate change.
That is the weakest link in the chain, and it's very much at the heart of the discussions that I'm having here.
He's pushing back against the notion that it's too much to cope with the financial crisis and the climate crisis simultaneously. And he's getting help from, among other people, Connie Hedegaard, Denmark's Minister for Climate and Energy. At a Brookings Institution event where the two appeared on Wednesday, Hedegaard argued this is precisely the time to push forward.
Not only because we need to tackle climate change, but also because how often are we provided with an opportunity to rethink business as usual?
Mr. Obama is trying to address climate change and the economy at the same time by stimulating green jobs, she noted, but that's not enough. In order to reduce carbon dioxide emissions, dirty energy will simply have to cost more. And Carlos Pascual from the Brookings Institution says that won't be an easy or quick sale on Capitol Hill.
I am absolutely confident that we are eventually going to get to a new regime on climate change.
I don't know if we're going to get there by Copenhagen.
Pascual said the worst-case scenario is that the U.S. goes to the talks in Copenhagen 9 months from now and is simply not ready to agree on a deal, despite all the international pressure. That could stop momentum for a climate treaty in its tracks.
Second-case scenario is that we have a rerun of Kyoto. We go to Copenhagen, and the United States makes all sorts of commitments on national emission targets. We come back here, and we can't pass them through the Senate.
And the Senate needs to ratify a treaty with 67 votes, which is even harder than getting 60 votes for domestic climate legislation. So he argues we need a fallback plan for Copenhagen in case the U.S. is not ready to sign a new climate treaty by the December deadline. Ivo de Boer, the Flying Dutchman, was having none of it.
You can't go to Copenhagen and mumble. There has to be a clear commitment to emission reduction targets on the part of industrialized countries.
De Boer's challenge is to create that consensus in the next 9 months, and the Obama administration isn't quite ready to go. As De Boer walks the Washington corridors looking for people to cajole, he says he still sees a lot of empty offices. Richard Harris, NPR News.
This is the Afternoon Magazine. It's 2:46 Central Time. This is the Afternoon Magazine. Good afternoon. I'm Celeste Quinn. This year's annual Purdue University Regional Rube Goldberg Machine Contest was won by the team from the University of Illinois. The team now heads back to Purdue for the national competition on March 28th. The win was quite a coup for the Illinois team. It was their first time out. You'll find a video of the event on our website, will.illinois.edu. Click on the Afternoon Magazine link. This was the team's assignment and the assignment for all the teams competing. Build a machine to change a light bulb. Change an incandescent bulb with a more energy-efficient, light-emitting design. Here's the hard part. Accomplish the task in the most complicated way possible. Well, two of the University of Illinois students on this winning team are my guests in this portion of the program. They'll tell us about their machine, the contest at Purdue, and what lies ahead. My guests are James Krieger, a sophomore in the College of Engineering, and Mickey Mangan, a senior in the College of Engineering. Good to see you. Congratulations.
Thank you very much.
Thank you.
What a great victory to pull off in West Lafayette.
Yeah, definitely. We weren't exactly expecting it because we were hoping for it and we were aiming for it, but this is the first year that U of I's ever built a machine and competed, and Purdue is notorious for winning the national competition every year. They founded the competition, I think, in 1983. It's been going on since then, and every single year, a Purdue team has won the regional, and so us to come in our first year of existence to win was a great success for us.
Yeah, and James, how many steps did it take? How much time did it take to change that light bulb?
Our machine had approximately 70 steps. And just to give you an idea, a step is considered to be anything that involves the transfer of energy. For example, having like a mousetrap go off or some dominoes fall or weights or like cars down ramps or anything that transfers energy from one form to another form is a step. So we had 70 of these used in our machine to go through and change this light bulb.
Yeah, can you give us some idea of what this contraption looks like, how big it is?
Sure. The rules say the machine has to be 6 feet by 6 feet by 6 feet tall. So ours is around there. We have a 6 by 6 foot base, and then we start up at the height, and then our machine is kind of tiered in layers. So you can almost put like a flat piece of wood down and form a nice little plane. That way you can see things in the back are raised up, then we have stuff in the middle and on the ground, and you have the different layers, so you can easily watch what's going on.
Yeah. How many are on the team, and when did you begin work on this?
Well, we Jimmy and I started the team back in September and started recruiting members. And at the beginning, interest was really high, and we had about 30 people show up to a few informational meetings. The amount of commitment kind of dwindled down to about 20 people contributing to the actual construction of the machine. And at Purdue, at the regional, we brought 9 students to go and help set it up and help reset the machine there.
Yeah.
So,
in the course of all those months, was there any one moment where you just really felt frustrated?
There were quite a few.
Quite a few. Yeah.
This is, you know, like the third machine I've built for these competitions. And as always, when you get to about end of January, beginning of February, you have the machine as you have it built, and then you try starting to run it and nothing works, and you definitely just want to like kick the thing over and trash it and set it on fire. I mean, it's usually what happens. And then after about that 2-week span, you hit like start of February, and then things start to work, and then it all becomes worth it.
Yeah. Was there a particular moment of eureka when you got something to work that you've been working on and working on and working on?
For me, that was the whole idea of changing the actual light bulb seemed like an extremely daunting task, and the actual mechanism that we'd go through was kind of obscure, and it was hard to visualize for me. And me and Jimmy and everybody talked about different ideas to do that, but I didn't see it actually happening until during our Christmas vacation. Jimmy and a few other people really committed to getting the actual mechanism down, and when I saw that and how like masterfully engineered it was, I was just, okay, we're in. This is real now.
Yeah, now here's the hard thing for me to imagine. You know, when I think of engineering and engineers, I think you're people who want the simplest, most elegant solution to a problem. And here you have to combine creativity with inefficiency and complexity. So do you have to turn your thinking as engineers inside out, upside down?
I think the idea of inefficiency is kind of misleading, because when you break the machine down into its individual components, each step is very, very meticulously engineered and precise. Like, each step as it goes is efficient. It's just stringing them all together into a kind of entertaining. Rube Goldberg is really all about entertainment, watching something that's fun to watch. And so it's definitely as difficult as making a small light bulb changer or whatever, and also as complicated too, I guess.
Yeah, the inefficiency they talk about is more like just making it long. Like, they have like minimum step requirements and stuff, but it's more about making the machine run for as long as possible and not like being crazy or like inefficient in like an energy wasting type sense.
Mm. Did your education here at Illinois in engineering help you out a great deal in terms of ideas and how to implement them? Or is this kind of really outside the classroom kind of stuff?
It's definitely outside the classroom. Yeah. Like occasionally you'll use something like, oh, I remember in physics or in this class I learned about this principle, and you'll kind of use the principle to get something done. But a lot of the building is more like just hands-on and more trial and error. Because like even with like engineering, you're always dealing with idealized things. And here we're in the real world, nothing's idealized. So you know like, well, if I set something up like this, it should work, but it really doesn't. So you have to tinker with it to actually get it to do what you need to do.
Yeah. Are you allowed any faculty input?
We're required to have a faculty advisor to be a recognized organization on campus. And so our advisor is Harry Dankowitz from the Mechanical Engineering Department, but he didn't even see the machine until it was already built. So it was all done on our own.
Yeah. Well, boy. Again, congratulations. This is quite a feat. Now, how many entries were in this year's regional contest at Purdue?
There were 7 teams, including ourselves.
Okay. And what do you think gave you the edge?
I think what gave us the edge was our theme. Each machine is required to have a unifying theme that kind of ties it together, so it's not just a bunch of balls and marbles and mousetraps and all sorts of stuff. So our theme this year that Mickey came up with was the board game Clue. So as you look at our machine, we have the whole board game drawn out, and the machine starts, we roll the dice, you start playing the game, and as you go through, all the weapons are included as part of our steps. All the characters are there, and in the end, after we've changed the light bulb, we have the murderer is actually revealed, so the game ends with the light bulb being changed.
That's great.
And that just, I think, made our machine stand out from everyone else's.
Yeah, and the characters, are they also in settings within the machine?
Yeah, they're in settings. Some of them are used as parts of steps. Like, you know, in one step we have, like, Mr. Green sitting on a chair, and his chair gets knocked over, and when his chair falls, he triggers the next step, and it just goes along like that.
Yeah, we gradually kill off each of the characters until you realize who is the culprit. I've been trying to pitch the catchphrase, how many murders does it take to screw in a light bulb?
Oh, very good.
It was a little grim.
Yeah, I was going to ask you, have you heard any new light bulb jokes over the course of this ordeal?
Yeah, I guess.
Yeah, that's all we've heard.
Yeah. Who was your toughest competitor, and was there another entry that you thought, these guys are good?
Yeah, the Purdue Society of Professional Engineers is highlighted on that video you mentioned. They've won the national competition 4 out of the last 5 years. And so they were going to be our biggest threat when we showed up. And during the actual running of the competition, their machine, they required human intervention to get the machine to work, and ours didn't. So that gave us the edge there.
Also, there was also another new group that was there that ended up in second place, actually. And they weren't actually, they weren't a group at all. They were just a bunch of, like, 5 or 6 guys, the Garage Yard Junkies. And their machine was themed like a garage, and they had, like, all sorts of, like, tools and all sorts of old car parts in there. And I really liked their machine a lot, especially at the end. What they did is, for their light bulb changer, they had an old set of headlights and then new fluorescent headlights. And so they ended up flipping the headlights on, and then they honked the car horn when they were done. And just some of the steps they did was really cool.
Very clever, very clever. How many teams will be competing in the national at the end of the month at Purdue?
I believe there will be 7 or 8, including ourselves. I know there are 6 for sure. When I talked to the guy in charge, Mike, the other day, and he said there are still, I think they're waiting to hear from 2 or 3 more.
Okay.
So,
well, the best of luck to you.
Thank you
very much.
Thanks for coming in and talking with us this
Thanks
afternoon.
Thanks for having us.
Thank you very much.
My guests in this portion of the Afternoon Magazine have been James Krieger, a sophomore in the College of Engineering, and Mickey Mangan, a senior in the College of Engineering. They are two of the team members of the University of Illinois team that won this year's Purdue University Regional Rube Goldberg Machine Contest. It took place earlier this year. When, in January?
February 21st.
Okay, and they're headed to the national competition now on March 28th at Purdue. It was quite a coup for this team. It was their first time out, and you can see their work, a video of it, on our website, will.illinois.edu. Click on the Afternoon Magazine link. Thanks again.
Thank you.
Earth and Sky.
You might picture the Arctic as endlessly white, but Skip Walker, a geobotanist at the University of Alaska, told us that satellite